tradition that went back a long way. There is a surviving snatch of Ennius's epic poem on the history of Rome that refers explicitly to the Second Punic War, in which he had fought as a Roman ally. It was written even before the Third had happened. In practical terms, the Romans directed enormous resources to warfare, and, even as victors, paid a huge price in human life. Throughout this period, somewhere between 10% and 25% of the Roman adult male population would have served in the legions each year, a greater proportion than in any other pre-industrial state, and, on the higher estimate, comparable to the call-up rate in World War I. Twice as many legions fought at Cannae as had fought at Sentinum some 80 years earlier, which is a convenient indication of the increasing size of these conflicts and the ever more complex and demanding logistics of equipment, supply, and animal transport. An army of the size the Romans and their allies fielded at Cannae would, for example, have needed around 100 tons of wheat alone every day. The deals with the local communities that this implies, the marshalling of the hundreds of pack animals, who added to the demand by necessarily consuming part of what they carried, and the collection and distribution networks would have been inconceivable at the beginning of the century. It is harder to put a figure on the casualties. There was no systematic tally of deaths on an ancient battlefield, and all numbers in ancient texts have to be treated with suspicion, victims of exaggeration, misunderstanding, and over the years some terrible miscopying by medieval monks. Nevertheless, the combined total of the Roman casualty figures that Livy provides for all the battles that he records in the first 30 years of the 2nd century BCE, so not including the massive losses sustained against Hannibal, comes to just over 55,000 dead. This is far too low. There was probably a patriotic tendency to downplay Roman losses. It is not clear whether allies as well as Roman citizens were included. There must have been some battles and skirmishes which do not feature in Livy's list, and those who subsequently died of their wounds must have been very many indeed. In most circumstances, ancient weapons were much better at wounding than killing outright. Death followed later by infection. But it gives a hint of the human cost of this warfare on the Roman side alone. The toll on the defeated is even harder to gauge, but was presumably worse. It is necessary, however, to see beyond this carnage, terrible as it was, to look harder at the reality and organisation of the fighting, and to investigate the domestic politics that underpinned Roman expansion, as well as the Roman ambitions and wider geopolitics of the ancient Mediterranean that may have encouraged it. Polybius is the most important guide, but there is other vivid contemporary evidence, often documents inscribed on stone, that makes it possible to trace some of the interactions between the Romans and the outside world. Accounts still survive that capture at first hand the bewildering experiences in Rome of envoys from small Greek towns. And we can still read the texts of detailed treaties between the Romans and the states abroad. The oldest fragment, from 212 BCE, is part of a much longer agreement between Rome and a group of Greek cities, and it sets out precise rules on how any war booty is to be divided between Rome and the others. Basically, cities and houses to the Greeks, movable property to the Romans. There were also important consequences for Rome itself of military success overseas. The literary revolution was only one part of it. By the mid-2nd century BCE, the profits of warfare had made the Roman people by far the richest of any in their known world. Thousands upon thousands of captives became slave labour that worked the Roman fields, mines and mills, that exploited resources on a much more intensive scale than ever before, and fueled Roman production and Roman economic growth. bullion by the barrow load taken or stolen from rich eastern cities and kingdoms poured into the well-guarded basements of the Temple of Saturn in the Forum, which served as the state treasury. And there was enough left over to line the pockets of the soldiers, from the grandest general to the rawest recruit. There was plenty for Romans to celebrate. Some of the cash was ploughed into new civic amenities, from new harbour installations and vast warehouses on the Tiber, to new temples lining the streets, commemorating the assistance of the gods in securing the victories that had brought all this wealth. And it is easy to imagine the widespread pleasure when, in 167 BCE, Rome became a tax-free state. The treasury was so overflowing, thanks in particular to the spoils from the recent victory over Macedon, that direct taxation of Roman citizens was suspended for more than 100 years, although they remained liable to a range of other levies, such as customs dues or a special tax charge on freeing slaves. Yet these changes were destabilizing too. It was not just that some curmudgeonly Roman moralists worried about the dangerous effects of all this wealth and luxury, as they put it. The expansion of Roman power raised big debates and paradoxes about Rome's place in the world, about what counted as Roman when so much of the Mediterranean was under Roman control, and about where the boundary between barbarism and civilization now lay, and which side of that boundary Rome was on. When, for example, at the end of the 3rd century BCE, the Roman authorities welcomed the great mother goddess from the highlands of what is now Turkey and solemnly installed her in a temple on the Palatine, complete with her retinue of self-castrated, self-flagellating, long-haired priests. How Roman was that? Winning, in other words, brought its own problems and paradoxes. But even the definition of winning and losing can be uncertain. Those uncertainties are sharply revealed in the story of the Battle of Cannae in the second of the Punic Wars. It gives a glimpse of the strategy, the tactics, and the real face of ancient combat, but for Polybius, and perhaps for Hannibal too, it raised the question of whether Rome's most notorious defeat was not in some ways the strongest indicator of its power. Cannae and the elusive face of battle. In 216 BCE, the authorities in Rome performed what Livy calls a very un-Roman ritual. They buried alive in the city centre two pairs of human victims, Gauls and Greeks. It was the closest to human sacrifice that the Romans ever came, and Livy's embarrassment in telling the story is evident. Yet it was not the only time they did this. The same ritual had been carried out in 228 BCE, in the face of a Gallic invasion from the north, and was again in 113 BCE when another such invasion threatened. In 216 BCE, the sacrifice was prompted by Hannibal's victory earlier that year at Cannae, 200 miles away to the southeast, which had left vast numbers of Romans dead after a single afternoon's fighting. Estimates vary from around 40,000 to 70,000. In other words, something at the level of 100 deaths a minute. There were all kinds of puzzles about this cruel ritual. Why this choice of nationalities? What relationship did it have to the similar burial alive of Vestal virgins who were convicted of breaking their vow of chastity, which also happened in 216 BCE and in 113 BCE? It certainly points to the fear and panic that hit Rome after, to see it in his terms for once, Hannibal's stunning victory. The Battle of Cannae and the whole history of the Second Punic War have mesmerized generals, pundits, and historians ever since. Probably no war has been re-fought so often in so many studies and lecture rooms, or been scrutinized so intently by the military men of the modern world. from Napoleon Bonaparte to Field Marshal Montgomery and Norman Schwarzkopf. Its causes remain as clouded in speculation and second-guessing as they ever were. Retrospectively, it became for the Romans another clash of superpowers and the stuff of epic poetry. Virgil's Aeneid even gives it a mythic origin in Roman prehistory, when the Carthaginian queen Dido, abandoned by her lover Aeneas on his way to found Rome, throws herself to her death onto a funeral pyre, cursing him and his whole race. In reality, it is hard to fathom either the Roman or the Carthaginian aims. Carthage, in its prime position on the North African coast, with impressive harbours and a grander cityscape than contemporary Rome, had wide trading interests in the Western Mediterranean, and might well have had reason to distrust the growing power of its Italian rival. Ancient and modern writers have pointed, in varying degrees, to Rome's provocation of Hannibal in Spain, and Hannibal's grudge against Rome for its victory in the First Punic War. At the latest count, there are more than 30 versions of what really lay behind the conflict. For many analysts, the strategic choices of the Romans and Carthaginians have been particularly intriguing and revealing. On Hannibal's side, these go far beyond the favourite puzzles about what elephant route he might have taken across the Alps, or whether his reported trick of breaking open alpine rocks by pouring vinegar on them could ever have worked. Probably not. The main issue has always been, why on earth, after the stunning victory at Cannae, did he not go on to take the city of Rome while he had the chance, but instead gave the Romans time to recover? Livy imagines one of Hannibal's officers, by the name of Maharbal, saying to him, "You know how to win a victory, Hannibal, but you don't know how to exploit it." Montgomery is only one of the many later generals who have agreed with Maharbal. Hannibal was a brilliant soldier and dashing adventurer who had the final prize within his grasp, but for some unfathomable reason, loss of nerve or some flaw of character, he failed to take it. Hence his tragic glamour. The eventual victory of the Romans highlights a much more down-to-earth clash of strategy and military style between, on the one hand, Quintus Fabius Maximus Verrucosus Cunctator, the last three names, greatest warty delayer, being a characteristic Roman combination of boastfulness and realism, and on the other, Scipio Africanus. Fabius took command after Cannae, avoided pitched battle with Hannibal, and played a waiting game, combining guerrilla tactics with a scorched-earth policy to wear down the enemy, hence delay. For some observers, this canny strategy largely won the day. Despite his close association with Africanus, Ennius credited Fabius with ensuring Rome's survival. "One man alone restored the state to us by delaying. Concando," he wrote. George Washington, the American Fabius, as he has sometimes been called, opted for similar tactics at the start of the American War of Independence, harassing rather than directly engaging the enemy, and even the British left-wing Fabian Society adopted his name and example, the message being, if you want the revolution to be successful, you must be, like Fabius, bide your time. But there have always been those who have thought Fabius a slow coach or a ditherer rather than a clever strategist, in contrast to the much more dashing Scipio Africanus, who eventually took over the command and persuaded the Senate to allow him to move the war into Africa and finish Hannibal off there. In describing that Senate meeting, Livy scripts a largely imaginary debate between the cautious elderly Fabius and Africanus, the energetic rising star. It polarises not only their different approaches to the war, but also different ways of understanding Roman virtus. Did manliness necessarily mean speed and vigour? Could it be heroic to be slow? Retrospective generalship can be misleading, however, especially when it comes to recreating what happened in any individual battle. Talk of tactics and all the splendid military diagrams that usually accompany it offers a highly sanitized version of Roman warfare and suggests that we know more about the face of Roman battle than we do, even about such a momentous engagement as Cannae. It is true that there are lengthy accounts in Polybius, who may have consulted eyewitnesses, Livy and other historians, but these are incompatible in details, hard to follow and in places almost nonsensical. We do not even know where exactly the battle took place, and the different proposed sites are the result of trying to match up conflicting versions in ancient writers with the layout of the land, as it might have been then, not forgetting the changed course of the nearby river. What is more, despite the almost mythical modern admiration for Hannibal's battle plans at Cannae, which are still on the syllabus of military academies, they amount to little more than a clever version of going round the back of the enemy. This was the one trick that ancient generals always tried if they could, for it offered the best chance of encircling the opposition and the only reliable way of killing or capturing them in large numbers. Indeed, it is hard to see how more sophisticated tactics could have been deployed in an ancient battle with more than 100,000 men on the field. How the commanders could have issued effective instructions to their armies, or how they could even have known what was going on in different areas of the fighting, are almost complete mysteries. Add to that the polyglot forces, whether multinational mercenaries or non-Latin-speaking allies of the Romans, strange star turns, some of the Gauls apparently fought naked, cavalrymen trying to manoeuvre and fight without the benefit of stirrups, a later invention, and in some engagements, though not at Cannae, as Hannibal's had all died by then, wounded elephants running wild and charging back into their own lines, and the picture is chaos. Aemilius Paulus may have had this in mind when he remarked, "A man who knows how to conquer in battle also knows how to give a banquet and organize games." He is usually taken to have been referring to the connection between military victory and spectacle, but he may have also been hinting that the talents of a successful general did not go far beyond basic organizational expertise. Nevertheless, Cannae was indeed a crucial turning point in the Second Punic War and in the longer history of Roman military expansion, precisely because the Romans lost so many men there and nearly ran out of cash. The basic bronze coin, the as, was reduced in weight over the course of the war from almost 300 grams to just over 50. And Livy tells how in 214 BCE, individual Romans were called upon to pay directly to man the fleet. A nice indication of the patriotism that surrounded the war effort, of the emptiness of the public treasury, but also of the cash that there still was in private hands, despite the crisis. Almost any other ancient state in that position would have been forced to surrender. Nothing underscores better the importance of Rome's enormous reserves of citizens and allied manpower than the single fact that it continued to fight the war. To judge from Hannibal's actions after Cannae, he perhaps saw this point too. It may not have been a loss of nerve that dissuaded him from marching on Rome. Realizing that allied manpower sustained Rome's strength, he directed himself to the slow process of winning over the Italian allies, with some success, but never in sufficient numbers to undermine Roman durability. That must also have been in Polybius's mind when he chose to insert into his histories a long digression on the strength of the Roman political system as it was at the time of Cannae. His overall aim was to explain why the Romans had conquered the world, and part of that explanation lay in the strength and stability of Rome's internal political structures. His account is the first more or less contemporary description of Roman political life to survive, Polybius was looking back 50 years or so, but also mixing in observations of his own time. And at the same time, it is the first attempt at a theoretical analysis of how Roman politics worked, one that sets the agenda even now. Polybius on the Politics of Rome. Polybius, who knew Rome as both an enemy and a friend, was uniquely well placed to reflect on the rise of the city and on its institutions. Born into the political aristocracy of a town in the Peloponnese, he was in his 30s in 168 BCE when Aemilius Paulus defeated King Perseus, and he found himself one of the 1,000 Greek detainees taken to Rome as part of the political purge, or precautionary measures, that followed. Most of them were placed under a light-touch regime of house arrest and scattered among the towns of Italy. Polybius, who already had a reputation as a writer, was luckier. He quickly fell in with Aemilianus. They apparently met over the loan of some books, and his family, and was allowed to stay in Rome, where he became the young man's de facto tutor, and as close as father to son. Snatches of Polybius's advice to Aemilianus were still being quoted or misquoted more than 200 years later. "Never come back from the forum," he is supposed to have urged, "until you have made at least one new friend." The surviving hostages were released around 150 BCE. Only 300 were still alive, and one outspoken Roman is supposed to have complained about the Senate wasting its time debating whether some elderly Greek should be buried by undertakers here or in Greece. But Polybius was soon back with his Roman associates, travelling with the army to Carthage and acting as an intermediary in the negotiations that followed the destruction of Corinth in 146 BCE. He was also still writing his histories, which ended up spreading over 40 books, mainly focusing on the years 220 to 167 BCE, with a brief flashback to the First Punic War and an epilogue to bring the story down to 146 BCE. Whoever was Polybius's main intended readership, Greek or Roman, his work became an important reference point for later Romans trying to understand their city's rise. It was certainly on Livy's desk when he was writing his history. Predictably, modern historians have found it hard to know quite where to fix the boundary between Polybius, the Roman hostage and critic of Roman rule, and Polybius, the Roman collaborator. He certainly sometimes performs a deft balancing act between his different loyalties, giving behind-the-scenes advice at one point to a distinguished Syrian hostage on how to slip away from his detention, while carefully insisting in his histories that on the day of the great escape he himself was at home, ill in bed. But whatever Polybius's political stance, he had the advantage of knowing both sides of the Roman story, and he had the opportunity to quiz some of the leading Roman players. He dissected Rome's internal organisation, which he insisted underpinned its success abroad, from a vantage point that combined a couple of decades of first-hand experience with all the sophistication of the Greek political theory in which he had been trained back home. His work is, in effect, one of the earliest surviving attempts at comparative political anthropology. Not surprisingly, his account is a wonderful combination of acute observation, bafflement, and occasionally desperate attempts to theorize Roman politics in his own terms. He scrutinized his Roman surroundings and his new Roman friends with care. He spotted, for example, the importance of religion or fear of the gods in controlling Roman behavior, and he was impressed with the systematic efficiency of Roman organization. Hence his important, but now often skipped, discussion of military arrangements with its teach-yourself rules about laying out an army camp, where the consul's tent should be pitched, how to plan a legionary baggage train, and the savage system of discipline. He was also sharp enough to see beneath the surface of various Roman customs and favourite pastimes, to their underlying social significance. All those stories of Roman valour, heroism and self-sacrifice that he must have heard, told and retold around military campfires or at dinner tables, were not simply for amusement, he concluded. Their function was to encourage the young to imitate the gallant deeds of their ancestors. They were one aspect of the spirit of emulation, ambition and competition that he saw running right through Roman elite society. Another aspect of this, one that he makes into an extended, if slightly ghoulish, case study, was to be found in the funerals of distinguished men. Again, Polybius must have witnessed enough of these to draw out their deeper significance. The body, he explains, was carried into the forum and placed on the rostra, normally propped up somehow in an upright position, so it was visible to a large audience. In the procession that followed, family members wore masks made in the likeness of the dead man's ancestors and dressed in the costume appropriate to the offices each had held, purple bordered togas and so on, as if they were all present, living and breathing. The funeral address, delivered by a family member, started with the achievements of the corpse on the rostra, but then went through the careers of all the other characters, who by this time were sitting on ivory, or at least ivory-veneered chairs, lined up next to the dead man. The most important upshot of this, Polybius concludes, is that the younger generation is inspired to endure all suffering for the common good, in the hope of winning the glory that belongs to the brave. This is perhaps a rather rosy view of the competitive side of Roman culture. Unchecked competition eventually did more to destroy than to uphold the Republic. Even before that, it is a fair guess that for every young Roman inspired to live up to the achievements of his ancestors, there was another oppressed by the weight of tradition and expectation that fell upon him. As Polybius might have realized, if he had chosen to reflect on all the stories in Roman culture about sons who killed their fathers. But it is a view nicely encapsulated in the words of another epitaph in the tomb of the Scipios, which it is tempting to think Polybius might have seen. I produced offspring, I sought to equal the deeds of my father, I won the praise of my ancestors so that they are glad that I was born to them. My career has ennobled my family line. At the heart of Polybius's argument, however, lay bigger questions. How could you characterize the Roman political system as a whole? How did it work? There was never a written Roman constitution, but Polybius saw in Rome a perfect example in practice of an old Greek philosophical ideal, the mixed constitution, which combines the best aspects of monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy. The consuls, who had full military command, could summon assemblies of the people and could give orders to all other officials, except the plebeian tribunes, represented the monarchical element. The Senate, which by this date had charge of Rome's finances, responsibility for delegations to and from other cities, and de facto oversight of law and security throughout Roman and allied territory, represented the aristocratic element. The people represented the democratic element. This was not democracy or the people in the modern sense. There was no such thing as universal suffrage in the ancient world. Women and slaves never had formal political rights anywhere. Polybius meant the group of male citizens as a whole. As in classical Athens, they and they alone elected the state officials, passed or rejected laws, made the final decisions on going to war, and acted as judicial court for major offences. The secret, Polybius suggested, lay in a delicate relationship of checks and balances between consuls, the Senate, and the people, so that neither monarchy nor aristocracy nor democracy ever entirely prevailed. The consuls, for example, might have had full monarchical command on campaign, but they had to be elected by the people in the first place, and they depended on the Senate for funding. and it was the Senate which decided whether the successful general should be awarded a triumph at the end of his campaign, and a vote of the people was required to ratify any treaty that might be made, and so on. It was, Polybius argued, such balances across the political system that produced the internal stability on which Roman external success was built. This is a clever piece of analysis, sensitive to the tiny differences and subtle nuances which distinguish one political system from another. To be sure, in some respects, Polybius tries to shoehorn the political life that he witnessed at Rome into a Greek analytical model that does not entirely fit, saddling his discussion with terms like democracy is, for example, deeply misleading. Democracy, democratia, was rooted politically and linguistically in the Greek world. It was never a rallying cry at Rome, even in its limited ancient sense, or even for the most radical of Roman popular politicians. In most of the conservative writing that survives, the word means something close to mob rule. There is little point in asking how democratic the politics of Republican Rome were. Romans fought for and about liberty, not democracy. Yet, in another way, by nudging his readers to keep sight of the people in their picture of Roman politics and to look beyond the power of the elected officials and the aristocratic Senate, Polybius sparked an important debate that is still alive today. How influential was the popular voice in Roman republican politics? Who controlled Rome? How should we characterize this Roman political system? It is easy enough to paint a picture of republican political processes as completely dominated by the wealthy minority. The upshot of the conflict of the orders was not popular revolution, but the creation of a new governing class comprising rich plebeians and patricians. The first qualification for most political offices was wealth on a substantial scale. No one could stand for election without passing a financial test that excluded most citizens. The exact amount needed to qualify is not known, but the implications are that it was set at the very top level of the census hierarchy, the so-called cavalry or equestrian rating. When the people came together to vote, the system of voting was stacked in favour of the wealthy. We have already seen how that worked in the centuriate assembly, which elected senior officials. If the rich centuries were united, they could determine the result without the poorer centuries even having the chance to vote. The other main assembly, based on geographical tribal divisions, was more equitable in theory, but, as time went by, not necessarily so in practice. Of the 35 geographical divisions, which were finally defined in 241 BCE, up to that point the number of tribes had increased as citizenship was extended through Italy, only 4 covered the city itself. The remaining 31 covered Rome's now far-flung rural territory. As votes could be cast only in person in the city, the influence of those who could afford the time and the transport to make the journey was overwhelming. The votes of the resident city population had an impact on only that tiny minority of urban tribes. Besides, strictly speaking, the assemblies were simply for voting on a list of candidates or on a proposal put by a senior official. There was no general discussion, no proposals or even amendments could come from the floor. In the case of almost every piece of proposed legislation we know of, the people voted in favour of what was put before them. This was not popular power as we understand it. Yet there was another side to it. As well as the formal prerogatives of the people that Polybius stresses, there are clear traces of a wider political culture in which the popular voice was a key element. The votes of the poor mattered and were eagerly canvassed. The rich were not usually united, and elections were competitive. Those holding or seeking political office set great store on persuading the people to vote for them, or for their proposed laws, and devoted enormous attention to honing the techniques of rhetoric that would allow them to do that. They ignored or humiliated the poor at their peril. One of the distinctive features of the Republican political scene were the semi-formal meetings, or contiones, often held immediately before the voting assemblies, in which rival officials tried to win over the people to their point of view. Cicero delivered his second and fourth speeches against Catiline, for example, at contiones. Quite how frequent or how well attended they usually were, we do not know for sure. But there are several hints that they involved political passion, vociferous enthusiasm, and very loud noise. On one occasion in the 1st century BCE, it was said that the shouting was so thunderous that a crow, which had the bad luck to be flying past, fell to the ground stunned. There are also all kinds of anecdotes about the importance and intensity of canvassing, and how the vote of the people could be won or lost. Polybius tells a curious story about the Syrian king Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, famous, or even manifest god, the son of Antiochus the Great, who had been crushed by Scipio Asiaticus. As a young man, he had lived more than a decade as a hostage in Rome before being swapped for a younger relative, the one whom Polybius later advised on his escape plans. On his return to the East, he took with him a variety of Roman habits that he had picked up during his stay. These mostly came down to displaying a popular touch, talking with anyone he met, giving presents to ordinary people, and making the rounds of craftsmen's shops. But most striking of all, he would dress up in a toga and go around the marketplace as if he were a candidate for election, shaking people by the hand and asking for their vote. This baffled the people in his showy capital city of Antioch, who were not used to this kind of thing from a monarch, and nicknamed him Epimenes, Bonkers, or, to preserve the pun, Fatuous. But it is clear that one lesson that Antiochus had drawn from Rome was that the common people and their votes were important. Equally revealing is an anecdote about another member of the Scipio family in the 2nd century BCE, Publius Cornelius Scipio Nascia. He was out canvassing one day in a bid to be elected to the office of aedile and was busy shaking the hands of voters, standard procedure then as now, when he came across one whose hands were hardened by work in the fields. "My goodness," the young aristocrat joked, "do you walk on them?" He was overheard, and the common people concluded that he had been taunting their poverty and their labour. The upshot, needless to say, was that he lost the election. So what kind of political system was this? The balance between the different interests was certainly not as equitable as Polybius makes it seem. The poor could never rise to the top of Roman politics, the common people could never seize the political initiative, and it was axiomatic that the richer an individual citizen was, the more political weight he should have. But this form of disequilibrium is familiar in many modern so-called democracies. At Rome, too, the wealthy and privileged competed for political office and political power that could only be granted by popular election and by the favour of ordinary people, who would never have the financial means to stand themselves. As young Scipio Nascia found to his cost, the success of the rich was a gift bestowed by the poor. The rich had to learn the lesson that they depended on the people as a whole. An empire of obedience. Polybius was in no doubt that Rome's stable constitution provided an important foundation for its success abroad. But he had experienced the sharp end of Roman warfare and also saw Rome as an aggressive power with imperialist aims to take over the whole world. "They made a daring bid," he insists at the end of his account of the First Punic War, "for universal domination and control, and they succeeded in their purpose. Not everyone agreed. There were even some Greeks, he acknowledged, who suggested that Rome's conquests came about by chance or unintentionally. Many Romans insisted that their overseas expansion resulted from a series of just wars. In the sense of wars undertaken with the necessary support of the gods, in self-defence or in the defence of allies, who had often solicited Rome's help, it was not aggression at all. If Polybius had lived to see, less than 100 years after his death, the larger-than-life-sized statues of Roman generals holding a globe in their hands, he would no doubt have felt vindicated. A vision of world mastery certainly lay behind many expressions of Roman power in the 1st century BCE and later. An empire without limit, as Jupiter is made to prophesy in Virgil's Aeneid. But Polybius was wrong, as his own narrative of events clearly shows. To imagine that at this earlier period the Romans were driven by that kind of acquisitive imperialist ideology, or some sense of manifest destiny. There was thirst for glory, desire for conquest, and sheer greed for the economic profits of victory at all levels of Roman society. It was not for nothing that the prospect of rich booty was dangled before the people when they were asked to vote on entering the First Punic War. But whatever fantasies might have been exchanged at the Scipios' parties, none of this adds up to a plan for world domination. Much like the extension of Roman control within Italy, this expansion overseas in the 3rd and 2nd centuries BCE was more complicated than the familiar myth of the Roman legions marching in, conquering and taking over foreign territory. First, the Romans were not the only agents in the process. They did not invade a world of peace-loving peoples who were just minding their own business until these voracious thugs came along. However cynical we might rightly be about Romans' claims that they went to war only in response to requests for assistance from friends and allies, that has been the excuse for some of the most aggressive wars in history, part of the pressure for Rome to intervene did come from outside. The world of the Eastern Mediterranean, from Greece to modern Turkey and beyond, was the context for most of Rome's military activity at this period. It was a world of political conflict, shifting alliances and continuous, brutal interstate violence, not unlike early Italy, but on a much vaster scale. This was the legacy of the smash-and-grab conquests of Alexander the Great, who died in 323 BCE, before he had to face what to do with those he had defeated. His successors formed rival dynasties, which became involved in a more or less unbroken series of wars and disputes with one another, and with smaller states and coalitions on their margins. Pyrrhus was one of these dynasts. Antiochus Epiphanes was another. After his detention at Rome and attempts at popular politics at home, he managed in his 10-year reign between 175 and 164 BCE to invade Egypt twice, Cyprus, Judea, also provoking the Maccabean Revolt, Parthia and Armenia. The more powerful Rome was perceived to be, the more these warring parties looked on the Romans as useful allies in local power struggles and courted their influence. Representatives from the East repeatedly came to Rome in the hope of winning moral support or military intervention. That is a running theme in the historical accounts of the period. There are plenty of envoys reported, for example, in the run-up to Aemilius Paulus's campaign against Perseus, trying to persuade the Romans to do something about the ambitions of Macedon. But the most vivid picture of how this courting worked in practice comes from Teos, a town on the western coast of modern Turkey. It is a mid-2nd century BCE inscription recording the attempts to draw the Romans into a minor dispute, about which nothing else is known, over some land rights between the city of Abdera in northern Greece and a local king, Cotys. The text is a thank you letter, carved on stone, addressed to the town of Teos by the people of Abdera, for the Teans had apparently agreed to send two men to Rome, almost lobbyists in a modern sense, to drum up Roman support for Abdera's case against the king. The Abderans described exactly how this pair operated, right down to their regular house calls on key members of the Senate. The delegates apparently worked so hard that they wore themselves out physically and mentally, and they met the leading Romans and won them over by paying obeisance to them every day. And when some of the people they visited appeared to be on Cotys's side, for he had also sent envoys to Rome, they won their friendship by laying out the facts and paying daily calls at their atria, that is, the main central hall of their Roman houses. The silence of our text on the outcome of these approaches hints that things did not go the Abderans' way. But the snapshot here of rival representatives not merely beating a path to the Senate, but pressing their case daily on individual senators, gives an idea of just how actively and persistently Roman assistance could be sought. And the literally hundreds of statues of individual Romans, as saviours and benefactors, put up in the cities of the Greek world, show how that intervention, if successful, would be celebrated. We cannot now identify every piece of doublethink behind such words. There was no doubt as much fear and flattery involved as sincere gratitude, but they are a useful reminder that the simple shorthand, Roman conquest, can obscure a wide range of perspectives, motivations, and aspirations on every side of the encounter. Besides, the Romans did not attempt to annex overseas territory systematically, or to impose standard mechanisms of control. That partly explains why the process of expansion could be so quick. They were not establishing any infrastructure of government. They certainly extracted material rewards from those they defeated, but in different ad hoc ways. They imposed vast cash indemnities on some states, a total of more than 600 tons of silver bullion in the first half of the 2nd century BCE alone. Elsewhere, they took over the ready-made regular taxation regimes set up by earlier rulers. Occasionally, they devised new ways of raking off rich revenues. The Spanish silver mines, for example, once part of Hannibal's domain, were soon producing so much ore that the environmental pollution from its processing can still be detected in datable samples extracted from deep in the Greenland ice cap. And Polybius, who visited Spain in the mid-2nd century BCE, wrote of 40,000 miners, mostly slaves, no doubt, working just one region of mining territory alone. Not literally, perhaps. 40,000 was a common ancient shorthand for a very large number, like our millions. The Romans' forms of political control were equally varied, ranging from hands-off treaties of friendship, through the taking of hostages as a guarantee of good behaviour, to the more or less permanent presence of Roman troops and Roman officials. What happened after Aemilius Paulus defeated King Perseus is just one example of how such a package of arrangements might look. Macedon was broken up into four independent, self-governing states. They paid tax to Rome at half the rate that Perseus had levied it, and in this case, the Macedonian mines were shut down to prevent their resources from being used to build up a new power base in the region. It was a coercive empire, in the sense that the Romans took the profits and tried to ensure that they got their own way when they wanted, with the threat of force always in the background. It was not an empire of annexation in the sense that later Romans would understand it. There was no detailed legal framework of control, rules or regulations, or, for that matter, visionary aspirations. At this period, even the Latin word imperium, which by the end of the 1st century BCE could mean empire in the sense of the whole area under direct Roman government, meant something much closer to the power to issue orders that are obeyed. And provincia, or province, which became the standard term for a carefully defined subdivision of empire under the control of a governor, was not a geographical term, but meant a responsibility assigned to Roman officials. That could be, and often was, an assignment of military activity or administration in a particular place. From the later 3rd century BCE, Sicily and Sardinia were regularly designated as provinciae, and from the early 2nd century BCE, two military provinciae in Spain were a standard fixture, though their boundaries were fluid. But it could equally well be a responsibility for, say, the Roman treasury, and around the turn of the 3rd and 2nd centuries BCE. Plautus, in his comedies, uses the word provincia as a joke to refer to the duties of slaves. At this point, no Roman was sent out to be the governor of a province, as they later were. What was at stake for the Romans was whether they could win in battle, and then whether, by persuasion, bullying or force, they could impose their will where and when and if they chose. The style of this imperium is vividly summed up in the story of the last encounter between Antiochus Epiphanes and the Romans. The king was invading Egypt for the second time, and the Egyptians had asked the Romans for help. A Roman envoy, Gaius Popilius Linas, was dispatched and met Antiochus outside Alexandria. After his long familiarity with the Romans, the king no doubt expected a rather civil meeting. Instead, Linas handed him a decree of the Senate instructing him to withdraw from Egypt immediately. When Antiochus asked for time to consult his advisers, Linas picked up a stick and drew a circle in the dust around him. There was to be no stepping out of that circle before he had given his answer. Stunned, Antiochus meekly agreed to the Senate's demands. This was an empire of obedience. The impact of empire. It was also an empire of communication, mobility, misunderstanding, and changing perspectives, as a closer look at that story of the delegation from Teos vividly reveals. It is easy enough to sympathize with the predicament of the underdog. The two men had sailed across half the Mediterranean on a journey that would have taken anything between 2 and 5 weeks, depending on the season of the year, the quality of the ship, and whether they were prepared to sail after dark. Night sailing could take a week off the journey, but was fraught with added danger. When they arrived in Rome, they would have been faced with a city that was larger, but considerably less elegant, than some they had passed through on the journey. One unfortunate Greek ambassador, at about the same time, is known to have fallen into an open Roman sewer and broken his leg, and made the most of his convalescence by giving introductory lectures on literary theory to a curious audience. Rome had strange foreign customs too. Interestingly, whoever at Abdera composed the text on the stone did not even try to translate some distinctively Roman terms, such as atria and patronus, patron, but merely transcribed them in Greek script. When they did venture a translation, it could be decidedly odd. The envoys were said, for example, to have offered daily obeisance to the Romans. The Greek word here, proskynesis, literally means bowing and scraping, or kissing the feet. This presumably refers to the Roman practice of salutatio, which involved clients and dependents paying a morning call on their patrons, but no kissing of feet at all. Though maybe these foreign visitors saw the practice for the humiliation it was. We can only guess how they made contacts or put their case. Many wealthy Romans spoke some Greek, better than the Teans would have known Latin, but not always very well. Real Greeks were known to have made wicked fun of the terrible Roman accent. Yet when this pair of Teans turned up in the city, some Romans may have felt uneasy too, for even if the attention and the recognition of Roman power was flattering, this was a new world, maybe almost as perplexing for them as for their visitors. What must it have felt like to be confronted with a stream of foreigners from as far away as it was possible to imagine, speaking too quickly in a language you only just understood, apparently extremely bothered about a small piece of land of which you knew nothing, and dangerously liable to bow down and kiss your feet? If, as Polybius put it, the Romans had conquered almost the whole of the known world in the 53 years up to 168 BCE, Then over that same period, Rome and Roman culture had been transformed too by those vastly expanded horizons. This transformation involved movements of people into and out of Rome on a scale never before seen in the ancient world. When slaves from all over the Mediterranean poured into Italy and into Rome itself, it was certainly a story of exploitation. But it was also one of massive forced migration. The figures that ancient writers give for the captives taken by Romans in particular wars may well be exaggerations. 100,000 in the First Punic War, for example, or 150,000 taken by Aemilius Paulus from just one part of Perseus's territory. And anyway, many of them would not have been transported directly back to Rome, but would have been sold to middlemen much closer to the point of capture. But it is a fair estimate that in the early 2nd century BCE, the numbers of new slaves arriving in the peninsula as a direct result of victories overseas averaged out at more than 8,000 per year, at a time when the total number of adult male Roman citizens inside and outside the city was in the order of 300,000. In due course, a significant proportion of these would have been freed and become new Roman citizens. The impact not only on the Roman economy but also on the cultural and ethnic diversity of the citizen body was enormous. The division between Romans and outsiders was increasingly blurred. At the same time, Romans poured overseas. There had been Roman travellers, traders and adventurers exploring the Mediterranean for centuries. Lucius, son of Gaius, the mercenary who left his name on an inscription on Crete in the late 3rd century BCE, cannot have been the first Roman to make his living in one of the world's oldest professions. But from the 2nd century BCE, thousands of Romans were spending long periods outside the Italian peninsula. There were Roman traders swarming over the eastern Mediterranean, cashing in on the commercial opportunities that followed conquest, from the slave trade and the spice trade to more mundane army supply contracts. Antiochus Epiphanes even hired a Roman architect, Decimus Cossutius, for building works in Athens, and we can track this man's descendants and ex-slaves still active in the construction business in Italy and the East decades later. But it was the soldiers, now serving for years on end overseas, rather than just for the traditional summer campaign at Rome's back door, who made up the majority of ordinary Romans abroad. After the Second Punic War, there were regularly more than 30,000 Roman citizens in the army outside Italy, anywhere from Spain to the eastern Mediterranean. This threw up a whole series of new dilemmas. In 171 BCE, for example, the Senate was confronted with a deputation from Spain, representing more than 4,000 men who were the sons of Roman soldiers and Spanish women. As there was no formal rite of marriage between Romans and native Spaniards, these men were, in our terms, stateless. They cannot have been the only ones with this problem. When Aemilianus later came as a new broom to take over the army command in Spain, he is said to have thrown 2,000 prostitutes out of the Roman camp. I suspect that the women might have defined themselves rather differently. But in the case before the Senate, the offspring concerned had the confidence to ask the Romans for a city to call their own, and presumably for some clarification about their legal position. They were settled in the town of Carteia, on the southern tip of Spain, which, with the Romans' usual flair for improvisation, was given the status of a Latin colony and defined as a colony of ex-slaves. How many hours of discussion it took the senators to decide that the bizarre combination of ex-slave and Latin offered the closest match available for the civic status of these technically illegitimate Roman soldiers' sons, we have no idea. But this certainly shows them grappling with the issues of what it was to be partly Roman outside Italy. By the mid-2nd century BCE, well over half the adult male citizens of Rome would have seen something of the world abroad, leaving an unknown number of children where they went. To put it another way, the Roman population had suddenly become by far the most travelled of any state ever in the ancient Mediterranean, with only Alexander the Great's Macedonians or the traders of Carthage as possible rivals. Even for those who never stepped abroad, there were new imaginative horizons, new glimpses of places overseas, and new ways of understanding their place in the world. The triumphal procession of victorious generals offered one of the most impressive windows onto the outside. When the Roman crowds lined the streets to welcome home their conquering armies, which paraded through the city with their profits and plunder on display, it was not only the astounding wealth that impressed them, though some of it would have astounded anyone at any period. When Aemilius Paulus returned in 167 BCE from his victory over King Perseus, it took 3 days to trundle all the loot through the city, including 250 truckloads of sculpture and painting alone, and so much silver coin that it needed 3,000 men to carry it, in 750 huge vessels. No wonder that Rome could afford to suspend all direct taxation. But it was also the dazzling display of foreign lands and customs that captured the popular imagination. Generals commissioned elaborate paintings and models to be carried in the procession, depicting famous battles and the towns they had captured, so the people at home could see what their armies had been doing abroad. The heads of the crowd were turned by the defeated eastern kings in their national dress and exotic regalia, by such curiosities as the pair of globes made by the Greek scientist Archimedes, who was killed in the Second Punic War, and by the exotic animals that sometimes became the stars of the show. The first elephant to tread the streets of Rome appeared in the parade for the victory over Pyrrhus in 275 BCE. It was all a far cry, as one later writer observed, from the cattle of the Volsci and the flocks of the Sabines, which had been the only spoils a century or so earlier. The comedies of Plautus and Terence offered a different kind of window, with some subtle and maybe unsettling reflections. It is true that the boy-gets-girl plots of almost all these plays, adapted from Greek predecessors, are not now best known for their subtlety. The happy ending to some of their rape stories can appall modern readers. Good news, the rapist was her fiancé all along, to summarise the denouement of one. It is also clear that the original performances, in public celebrations of all kinds, from religious festivals to the after-party of triumphs, were unruly, raucous occasions, attracting a wide cross-section of the population of the city, including women and slaves. This is in sharp contrast to classical Athens, where the theatre audience, though larger than at Rome, was probably restricted to male citizens, unruly or not. Nonetheless, there was one thing that all these Roman plays demanded of those who came to watch, that they faced the cultural complexity of the world in which they lived. That was partly because the plays are set in Greece. The assumption was that the audience had some sense of places outside Italy, or at least some name recognition of them. The plots often turned on decidedly diverse themes. One comedy of Plautus brings a Carthaginian onto the stage who babbles some possibly accurate but still incomprehensible Punic. Another features a couple of characters disguised as Persians, and to laugh at actors who are meant to be badly disguised as Persians is a much more knowing response than to laugh at actors who are simply meant to be Persians. But with a sophistication that is startling at such an early stage in the history of Roman literature, Plautus exploits even further the hybrid character of his work and of his world. One of his favourite gags, which he repeats in the prologue to a number of plays, is some version of Demophilus wrote this, Plautus barbarized it. Referring to his Latin, barbaric, translation of a comedy by the Greek playwright Demophilus. This apparently throwaway line was, in fact, a clever challenge to the audience. For those of Greek origin, it no doubt gave the opportunity for a quiet snigger at the expense of the new, barbaric rulers of the world. For the others, it demanded the conceptual leap of imagining what they might look like from the outside. To enjoy the laugh, they had to understand, even if only as a joke, that to Greek eyes, Romans might appear to be barbarians. The widening horizons of empire, in other words, disturbed the simple hierarchy of us over them, the civilized over the barbarous, which had underpinned classical Greek culture. Romans were certainly capable of scornfully dismissing conquered barbarians, of contrasting their own civilized, sophisticated selves with the crude, long-haired, woad-painted Gauls, or other supposedly inferior species. Indeed, they often did just that. But from this point on, there was always another strand of Roman writing which reflected more subversively on the relative position of the Romans in the wider world, and on how the balance of virtue was to be set between insiders and outsiders. When 3 centuries later the historian Tacitus insinuated that true Roman virtue was to be found in the barbarians of Scotland and not in Rome itself, he was developing a tradition of argument that went right back to these early days of empire and of literature. How to be Roman? The empire's new horizons also helped to create, or at least to define with much sharper edges and ideological significance, the image of the old-fashioned Roman. That down-to-earth, no-nonsense, hardy, warts-and-all character plays his part in our stereotype of Roman culture even now. The chances are that he was largely a creation of this period too. Some of the most outspoken voices of the 3rd and 2nd century BCE became famous for attacking the corrupting influence on traditional Roman behaviour and morals of foreign culture in general, and Greek culture in particular. Their targets ranged from literature and philosophy to naked exercise, fancy food, and depilation. In the forefront of the critics was Marcus Porcius Cato, Cato the Elder, a contemporary and rival of Scipio Africanus, whom Cato criticised for, among other things, cavorting in Greek gymnasia and theatres in Sicily. He is also supposed to have dubbed Socrates a terrible prattler, to have recommended a Roman medicinal regime of green vegetables, duck and pigeon, rather than anything to do with Greek doctors who were liable to kill you, and to have warned that Roman power could be brought down by the passion for Greek literature. According to Polybius, Cato once remarked that one sign of the deterioration of the Republic was that pretty boys now cost more than fields, jars of pickled fish, more than ploughmen. He was not alone in these views. In the middle of the 2nd century BCE, another prominent figure successfully argued that a Greek-style theatre built in Rome should be demolished, as it was better and more character-forming for Romans to watch plays standing up, as they had traditionally done, rather than sitting down in decadent Eastern fashion. In short, so these arguments went, what passed for Greek sophistication was no more than insidious softness, or molitia in Roman jargon, which was bound to sap the strength of the Roman character. Was this a simple conservative backlash against newfangled ideas being brought into Rome from outside, a bout of culture wars between traditionalists and modernisers? In part, perhaps it was, but it was also more complicated and interesting than that. For all his huffing and puffing, Cato had taught his son Greek, and his surviving writing, notably a technical essay on farming and agricultural management, and substantial quotations from his speeches and from his history of Italy, shows that he was well practised in the Greek rhetorical tricks that he claimed to deplore. And some of the claims being made about Roman tradition were little short of imaginative fantasy. There is no reason whatsoever to suppose that venerable old Romans had watched theatrical performances standing up. The evidence we have suggests quite the reverse. The truth is that Cato's version of old-fashioned, no-nonsense Roman values was as much an invention of his own day as a defence of long-standing Roman traditions.